thank you all for coming on time. Backbenchers can come forward. You don't have to sit in the back of the room. Steve's a very nice guy. He's not going to yell at you or throw things at you. Hi, Kathy. Thank you so much for coming. I think Steve, as the old saying goes, needs no introduction but deserves one. Steve is probably the one that I always try to see as much as I can when I get to the Philippines to find out what is really going on. Unfortunately, he's usually traveling someplace else to garden spots like Bangladesh or Papua New Guinea, and other wonderful sites in Asia, so it's sometimes very hard to catch him. But I'm delighted that he's willing to take some time from his vacation in the States to stop and see us here at USIP and talk a little bit about peace and development in Mindanao. And he picked the title, not I. His title is Kicking the Can Down the Road. But he is well known in the Philippines, has been there many years, and I think known to most of you, so I don't need to really introduce him very much. He used to be a professor at University of the Philippines, and as I understand correctly, the only one who, I'm only American given tenure at UP. So that tells you something. But other than that, he has been very active in Mindanao, both in terms of the peace process, but also in terms of education. And his recent study on the RIDO, which the Asia Foundation sponsored, I think is really a singular work on the subject and one that gives us a lot of information. So, Steve, with regrets for your interrupting your lunch, come and tell us a little bit about peace and development in Mindanao.
Thanks, Gene. I can't tell you how glad I am to be here. I find vacations exhausting because my family seems to think I should be on vacation during the day and my office seems to think I should be working during the night. So at least when I take time off from my vacation, I'm only working half the time. I am glad to be here, though. It's nice to have two talks in Washington so that I can achieve a little focus in the two different talks instead of trying to say everything. I generally get back once or twice a year, and sometimes I feel like I'm trying to say too much. As Gene said, I was for 18 years a professor at the University of the Philippines in Baguio. So I mostly knew Mindanao as a contrasting study when I was working on autonomy for the Cordillera. If anybody's interested in autonomy for the Cordillera, I'd be glad to talk about that in exhaustive detail. All I'll say on it now is that whenever I write an article about the movement for autonomy in Mindanao, not plagiarizing at all from USIP, but it's going to be called First Time Tragedy, Second Time Farce.
Not absurd, but farce.
Not absurd. As soon as I became Foundation rep in 1999, we made a strategic decision to start emphasizing Mindanao. We have long been involved. We've been in the Philippines since 1954. We've long been involved in Mindanao issues. We're the founding donor to Mindanao State University College of Law, or we gave the grants to help write the Code of Muslim Personal Law and that kind of thing. But in the 90s, it had been de-emphasized. And we thought we'd start building a program, and now we have a substantial program in Mindanao. The majority is funded by USAID, but we also have ADB funding, private funding. We're seeking other sources of funding because we'd like to have a well-rounded program. We have small offices in Zamboanga and Cotabato City, 2 to 3 person offices, because we, as you will hear from my talk, find the complexities so daunting in trying to do work that we need to keep very close tab on what's going on. So what I thought I'd do, at least for the opening remarks, and then we open it up for discussion amongst people, is first talk about those complexities I just mentioned, the complexities that I see in dealing with the issues of peace and development in Mindanao. Then briefly characterize the current status of the movement towards peace in Mindanao. I'll be brief there, in part because people in this room pay more day-to-day attention to it than I do, frankly. I do follow it, but it's not my full-time job. Finally, talk about some ways that I would suggest moving forward from the kicking the can down the road status that I see at the moment. The first complexity that I would refer to, and it's already been mentioned by Gene, is the complexity in the conflict status itself. we did a study in conjunction with the president's, with the Office of the President in late 2002, and found that, in fact, people cited more often clan or family conflicts than they cited separatist or religious conflict as occurring in their communities. So we started to build a program around the investigation of this, what is called Rido in Maranao. It's got different names in different languages, but basically clan feuds, clan conflicts that go on in Mindanao. There are thousands of them. If you look closely enough, they've caused thousands of casualties. One of the reasons we were very interested in it is that it often got entangled with the separatist conflict. That is, one side of a clan conflict would be have connections with the MILF, and the other side would have connections with the militia or the government forces. And so the organized armed forces would be drawn in to what was really a clan conflict, just a feud going on. I think we made a considerable amount of progress on this. We have a good deal of material up on our website. It's got a long web address, but basically if you go to the AsiaFoundation.org website and go to the Philippines and click on conflict, you'll get to it. There are about 10 papers up there that have been done by various research institutions in Mindanao characterizing Rido and so on. We're doing a book. As all books, it's taking longer than one had hoped, but it will be good when it comes, believe me. And in the meantime, we've been briefing people as much as we can. We've briefed the coordinating committees for the cessation of hostilities. We've briefed the international monitoring teams. We've briefed members of Congress. And in that sentence, when I say we, I mean the Filipino researchers are doing the work. It's not me doing the briefing. But we wanted to make sure that they understood that this was going on. And I think if you look at reports now, not only do the news organizations more readily understand that we're talking about feuds or clan conflicts, but also it's less likely to spark a wider conflict. So I think that's one of the things that we've been working on, and we've made a certain amount of progress. There are all sorts of other conflicts going on down there, which are not Muslim separatist conflicts. The NPA conflict is going down, the communist insurgency, and there are some linkages and boundaries between them. There are conflicts over natural resources. Recently, a mayor was killed because he was going against illegal fisher folk. There are mining conflicts and so on. So there's a lot of different conflicts ongoing, and it tends, when we're talking in Washington about the conflict in Mindanao, you know, we're usually talking about the Muslim separatist conflict, and I just wanted to introduce that complexity. A second complexity, a dimension of complexity that I would point to is the enormous complexity organizationally of the situation down there. I mean, we all know that the Moro Islamic Liberation Front broke away from the Moro National Liberation Front, in part because of a disagreement about independence, in part because of the more Islamic character of Hashim Salamat's leadership. There is the Abu Sayyaf down there. There is the Jamaa Islamiya. And these are typically characterized as four different versions of Muslim armed conflict. But even going beyond that, I'd like to point out several things. First thing, and I think it's important to remember, is that the MNLF's parallel state structure is still in existence. The first draft of this said still intact, and intact is such a strong word in the Philippines when there's so much factionalism. But there are still MNLF state commanders. There are still MNLF state structures that parallel the government's structure, the government's municipalities and provinces and the like. And they still function. Partly they function because they're used to distribute aid. The United States Agency for International Development's Arms to Farms, whatever it's being called in the current incarnation, I think it's LEAP, Livelihood Enhancement Assistance Project, actually uses the MNLF state structure for its client selection, for its beneficiary selection, for its project monitoring and so on. So they do form a continued existence. What they are not is a normal political party. They can't win elections, okay, which is part of the next point. Because the next point is, in fact, about the autonomous region of Muslim Mindanao. Now, there is a regional government. It is often thought and used to be more often characterized as the MNLF's government down there. Well, in the first place, after the reign of Nur Misauri, after his term of office, it wasn't so much, and now it is not at all an MNLF government. There is no MNLF ranking leader in any position of leadership in the ARMM. The last remaining ranking leadership was the Speaker Hassan, and he was ousted a couple of months ago in a move from the executive branch of the ARMM. So there is a regional government there in place, which was originally in 1987 put in place as a attraction to the MNLF to get into negotiations, and then was the subject of negotiations in 1996, and then in 2001 was the subject of congressional action and Misauri protest that landed him in jail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there is an organizational structure with this long and complex history. It is currently in the hands of what one could best characterize as traditional Datus. Okay, the Ampatuans are of the lineage of the Sultan of Maguindanao, but you know there are many different competing lineages from the Sultan of Maguindanao. But the Ampatuans are the ones that are currently on top, and they ran their campaign rather explicitly in the traditional fashion. That is, going to the various leaders and saying, "If you support us, you will get X." That's got its good parts and its bad parts. I mean, the good part is, for instance, it's the first time that the regional government has actually given money to local governments. They're giving, I think it's 1 million pesos a year to local governments for their infrastructure and so on. The bad part is, of course, that it is totally out of the hands of revolutionary governments right now. It's not either the Moro National Liberation Front, much less the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, is out of the picture with respect to the ARMM. As a for instance, Governor Ampatuan is not, and in this case I'm being deliberately ambiguous about which Governor Ampatuan I'm talking about, whether it's the Maguindanao provincial governor or the ARM regional governor, but Governor Ampatuan is against having the Bangsamoro Development Agency, Bangsamoro Development Agency be the conduit for overseas development assistance because it's under the control of the MILF. And, in fact, the donors, if you went to the donors meeting in Tagaytay, at the Mindanao Working Group meeting, there was no representative from the formal government of the ARMM there. There was nobody from the ARM. There was nobody from any local government in the ARM. The ones who were there were the ones from the Bangsamoro Development Agency because that's who is being interacted with by the World Bank, the Japanese, perhaps the Americans after a peace agreement and so on. So we have another possible parallel structure being set up, the BDA, which is being opposed by the current government of the regional. Thirdly, I'd like to mention the local government. One of the things that I try to contribute to Mindanao Working Group meetings in the Philippines is to say that local governments in the autonomous region of Basel-Mindanao are not uniformly hopeless. Okay. The fact of the matter is that the Asia Foundation is able to work with more than half of the municipalities in ARMM in productive ways. There are some really good local governments in ARM. There are some really bad local governments in ARM, and most of them are in the middle. And can those who are willing to be worked with, you can work them towards the good end. So there are lots of people there who are not at all involved in the MILF peace process, although they are the duly elected officials of the region. Finally, in talking about organizational complexity, I just spent a week doing a tour with my compatriot from Indonesia, Doug Ramage. And in Indonesia, you've got a couple of huge Muslim organizations that account for about 80% of the Muslims in Indonesia. In the Philippines, as I hope everybody knows, we have no such thing. And sometimes it's a little difficult to figure out who your interlocutor ought to be on any particular issue. The most widely known is the Ulama League of the Philippines. It's part of the Bishops Ulama Conference. It's part of the formal peace process because it's linked to the Office of the Presidential Advisor on the Peace Process. And the Ulama League of the Philippines has no representatives from any of the island provinces. Nobody from Sulu, Tawi-Tawi, or Basilan is in the Ulama League of the Philippines. So, you know, that whole section of the Autonomous Region of Moslem Mindanao is not represented by that organization. So one needs to really be interacting with a wide variety of groups. Perhaps best known here in USIP is the Philippine Council for Islam and Democracy, because the lead convener is Amina Rasul, who was here a while ago. And they're very active, you know, doing international work there, interacting with the Department of National Defense. That was what was happening the day before I left. There was a big conference of PCID and members of the military talking through some issues and so on. We have Shia, we have Ahmadiyya, we have Tabligh, we have Muslim Brotherhood, we have Balik Islam. I mean, there's all sorts of different strains going on in Islam. So it's when talking about doing work in these issues, one needs to keep this complexity in mind. Okay, so I'm to the second point now, and that is a brief characterization of the state of the peace process. Again, many of you know a lot about this in the room, so I'll just be very brief here. They've been in talks off and on for a good deal of time. Perhaps the most important point is there have been no formal talks for 4 years. Okay, there have been exploratory talks over and over and over again for the last 4 years. They held what they called the 12th round in May. I'll have to trust their count, you know, they ought to know. What seems to be going on is they're trying to iron out all the differences in these confidential working group meetings before they present them to the peace panels for basically formal ratification. Now, this has some interesting organizational problems for the Asia Foundation, because we gave grants to civil society organizations to be observers in the peace talks 4 years ago, and there haven't been any peace talks yet, so we have to keep giving them extensions on this grant, you know. And neither they nor we can keep the interest on the money, which is too bad. Where was I going to go with that? Where they are now in public is that they are having troubles coming to closure on the issues of ancestral domain. This is an issue on which USIP has tried to help. The old way of characterizing it before it went secret, the old way of characterizing the difference was the Moral National Liberation Front considered ancestral domain as what they wanted for their governing entity, and that was everything where Muslims used to be. Whereas the Moro Islamic Liberation Front in public said that they really only wanted to have an Islamic governance where there were still majority Muslim. Now, I don't know. I mean, that used to be the public position. I don't know what the state of play is for the ancestral domain issue. The second one is actually, what do you do for governance structure? And right now they're using the deliberately vague term of Bangsa Moro juridical entity. Yeah, BJE. So we have BDA and BJE and ancestral domain and so on. To my mind, you know, they've been doing this for quite some time. There's been a ceasefire that has held since mid-2003, after the Buliuk complex invasion of early 2003 settled down a little bit. The ceasefire has been originally they had the first entity for it beginning in August of 2001 was the local monitoring teams. The non-government organizations fairly quickly put together a parallel set of interventions called Bantay Ceasefire or Ceasefire Watch. And finally, the international monitoring team led by the Malaysians have come in. The international monitoring team, I believe, is 43 people, mostly Malaysians.
63,
okay. I'm open to correction on that. Mostly Malaysian, but also Libyans and Bruneis. And interestingly enough, a couple of weeks ago, there was an entry in the newspaper that the Japanese wanted to join the international monitoring team. The Japanese, for instance, have given training money to BDA people. So they're getting as involved as the other donors are, and just as directly. Let me just give you an idea. From April, a shooting war between government militia and elements of the MILF in Carmen and North Cotabato was averted by a peace mission composed of government, rebel, and civil society representatives. The Joint Committee on the Cessation of Hostilities, the grassroots-led Bantay Ceasefire, the International Monitoring Team, and the local monitoring team of the MILF were dispatched to the sitio a day after they learned about the shooting incident. So they are doing fairly quick response to these issues. So it is a process that has been holding. It has been able to settle things down considerably. The count of incidents is way, way, way down from 3 or 4 years ago. Now, there is a problem here in the sense that the MNLF is not necessarily very happy about the IMT structure. I mean, in the first place, the MNLF is somewhat more suspicious of the Malaysians. MNLF is centered on Tausugs, and Tausugs remember the Sultanate of Sulu, and they're a little irritated with the Malaysians for having most of the Sultanate of Sulu territorially. But more abstractly or more to the point, perhaps, it is a way around the Organization of Islamic Conferences intervention that the MNLF had. The OIC sent a observer or assessment mission about last month, I think it was, to look at the implementation of the 1996 peace accord. The OIC set a meeting in Jeddah for early July and suggested to the government that they release Nur Misauri in order that Nur could attend this. The MNLF over the weekend agreed that they would not attend unless Nur Misauri could attend, which makes perfect sense, of course. They are trying to once again unite behind the leadership of Nur Misauri of some sort, and the OIC is perhaps their best bet at getting him out of jail. Now, when we're looking at this, there are very real Christian-Muslim divides that are not generally talked about, but which are, you know, behind everybody's mind. It's not politically correct to deal too much on it. We do have a project called Prejudice and Pride, where we're examining Christian biases against Muslims with the aid of Pagbabago at Pilipinas, an organization is such a strong word, a group of people who look at interesting ways, and we're doing it with the Philippine Council for Islam and Democracy, and the Armed Forces of the Philippines is involved, and other conveners to try to get at some of these issues. I just like to use an example I often use, and that is Celso Lobregat, the mayor of Zamboanga City. Celso Lobregat is a member of a Christian clan. You know, his mother was mayor until she died, and then he took over. He is often seen as one of the main oppositors of peace in Mindanao. For instance, he objected to having the international monitoring team have an office in his city, because the international monitoring team, under their terms of reference, would have armed MILF guards. And his response was, nobody but duly constituted Philippine government people in my city carry guns. Okay, that's what he's trying to do. If you fly into Zamboanga City and the airport, it says, welcome to Zamboanga, a gunless city, which kind of surprised some young Americans we sent there a couple of weeks ago. But anyhow, he is actually very serious about it. I mean, it's a normal problem of mayors of cities with lots of municipalities around it. It's not just a Muslim-Christian problem. Lots of times the mayors of the cities want to make sure that other people's gunfights are kept outside their cities. So he objected. He objects to the inclusion of Zamboanga City in any ancestral domain definition. Now, Zamboanga City has twice voted not to be included in an autonomous region of Muslim Mindanao. He can't see why that should even be on the table. But it is when they held a briefing about it in April, the peace panel refused to rule it out. They refused to, you know, not so much that they say we can't rule it out. They basically said we can't talk about it. Right, and you can imagine what his reaction was. He doesn't want observer status to the peace talks. Quote, we will die in agony with an observer status, since an observer cannot influence, but only validate the outcome of a final agreement, end quote. Okay, so he's there. On the other hand, you know, Mayor Lobregat is a guy you can deal with. We work with him on business processing, business license processing, you know, streamlining business processes in his city. He's tripled his business income in the last year by just making it easier for businesses to register, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He is the one, for those of you who follow it, who basically kept the Philippines out of Tier 3, trafficking against persons. Philippines was on Tier 3 watch list because there had been no convictions. It wasn't the reason. He wasn't even aware of the watch list, but he doesn't like trafficking in persons, and he gave the court the resources to do continuous trial until they got some convictions, which got the Philippines jumped up to Tier 2 off the watch list. So he is actually a fairly effective, good mayor, and it seems to me that we need to deal with him, people like that. So there are those issues about going forward which bring us into conflict with the Christians in Mindanao. Some people use the term settlers, but in fact there were something like 100,000 Christians when the in 1898 when the Spanish lost Mindanao. So, I mean, they've been there a very long time. Finally, in terms of just kicking the can down the road, I'll mention briefly the current status, political status of President Arroyo, which was mostly the subject of my talk yesterday. I do expect President Arroyo to last out her term, sure. I see no reason to think that the opposition will ever become any better at ousting her. But the limits of her ability to get anything through, I think, are illustrated by, once again, the fact that there is no budget in the Philippines. They took 5 months overtime for the 2006 budget and finally gave up. So we are now in 2006 operating on the 2005 budget. If you're going to make promises, you're going to need to get some of those promises through Congress, and it's very difficult for the president in her current political state to get anything through Congress, even if Congress is supposedly on her side. So to me, it seems likely that the MILF will wait at least a year to figure this out, rather than sign an agreement with the lame duck president, a possibly lame duck president. They'll see what happens after May 2007, after the elections that are currently scheduled, to see if she comes out stronger. If she comes out looking stronger, then there's somebody she can deal with. Here's a visual aid. This is actually from early June. It says the MNLF executive sees 2006 as a bad year for the agreement. And it says expressed doubts they would sign a peace agreement. He said the number 6 in 2006 has a satanic color, making the year not an ideal time for signing any peace agreement with the government. Citing previous moral experiences with the number 6, Mantawal said that agreements signed during those periods always containing that number had always failed. 1996 peace agreement, 1976 Tripoli agreement, 1986 Jeddah Accord with Aquino, and so on. He later said that was a joke. Okay. I mean, as near as I can tell, there are no unlucky numbers in Islam. And, you know, they don't believe in 13 and stuff like that. It's sure to come up with something that's unlucky. There's some hadith expressing it from Muhammad. But in any case, nobody caught that it was a joke, and so it took about a week before he said it was a joke. But, I mean, what it really is I don't think there will be a peace agreement this year. And if there's not a peace agreement by January, then we're in election for May 2007, so that's why I think it will last a year. Now, I am not necessarily against kicking the can down the road. Okay, there's nothing necessarily bad about keeping progress going and making sure that you are able to keep conflict damped down. MILF has been cooperating in the fight against kidnapping and crime. A couple of weeks ago, they stopped a kidnapping in Lanao Norte, I think it was, and had a joint press conference with the MILF and the CCCH and the IMT and the armed forces, you know, demonstrating the kidnappers that they had captured. Cattle rustlers, a lot of the general criminality is being clamped down on. The controversy is about whether or not they're helping to clamp down on Jamaa Islamiyah. The Philippine government has given a list of sometimes I hear 30 and sometimes 40 names to the MILF. Whichever number it is, the MILF certainly hasn't handed any of them over. They are now currently engaged in a controversy about whether or not they block military movements through their camps after these people. The general in charge of the 6th Infantry Division says they do, and they claim they don't. But in any case, things are much better than they were, and if we can keep it up, this is not original with me. Somebody said it this morning when I was giving him the analogy. We've been kicking the can down the road in Ireland now for 6 or 7 years, right? And that, you know, it's better than having a war. So how would I suggest that we move forward from a kicking the can down the road scenario into something more forward-looking, more productive? And in this, I'm basically channeling Consensus Building Institute, which USIP is familiar with, and their mutual gains approach, and essentially Dealing with an Angry Public is a book that has some very interesting ideas. Rudy Rodil, professor at MSU-IIT, who was on the 1996 panel and is once again on the panel for the MILF, he says the worst time of his life was when he was trying to explain the 1996 final peace agreement in Christian areas. That was his job. He was the Christian, right? So he went to the Christian areas. He literally got rotten fruit thrown at him. The kind of thing you only see in cartoons actually happened to him. He said it was the worst part of his life dealing with the angry public. Why are people angry? Because they've been adversely affected by what you've done. They're worried about what you're going to do, or they're opposed ideologically to what you're trying to do, okay? And Consensus Building Institute says that essentially traditional responses to this don't work. You need to be more proactive. You need to bring people into the dialogue in structured ways that allow them to be part of the process before you're defensive at giving them an end result. So you're supposed to take the initiative, seek consensus. Don't try to show how wrong those Christians are to be opposed to this, but rather try to bring them into what can we live with. Is there an agreement that allows the ARMM complex in Zamboanga City to remain with the ARMM, whereas something else is given to Zamboanga City? I don't know. Nobody's ever explored this. Everybody just says that complex is for ARMM or that complex can't be for ARMM. They don't negotiate about it. Try to get people to focus on outcomes. Sometimes people talk about interests rather than talking about their ideologies or their opinions. What is it that you really need in order to be able to live with an agreement? Need to build credibility slowly and build legitimacy. Part of what I see repeatedly, and this is true with the constitutional change in the Philippines, for instance, where the Joe DiVinicius said a constitutional convention would take too long and we should do it quickly with a constituent assembly. 5 years later, we still want to do it quickly with a constituent assembly. It probably would have been faster to do it with a constitutional convention. The same sort of thing. People keep trying to talk about a fast agreement. I mean, a remark I've heard is, ever since people have been paying attention to it, the agreement has been 6 months away. Okay. Well, if it's only going to be 6 months away, we don't have time for consultations and stuff like that. Well, but if it's actually 5 years away, you have plenty of time to do it. And if you're trying to get it right, you may have to do it slowly. Now I'm talking about possible programs and stuff like that. But roughly speaking, it would be a situation of joint fact-finding and negotiation. We have explored this with particular respect to the 1996 final peace agreement, and we have agreement from both the MNLF and from the Office of the Presidential Advisor on the Peace Process that we could have people sit down, jointly agree on what they know about the implementation, what they don't know, what are the questions of fact, and how they might settle those questions of fact. I mean, how much money has flown to the ARMM? I mean, for instance, is a disputed fact. I mean, it seems to be fairly simple to clear that up, but nobody trusts the other side to clear it up. That's why it's joint fact-finding. You need to find people who can speak on behalf of but not for communities, people who are willing to talk and accurately represent a community without making any commitments because this is a public process. You need to engage the silent majority. One of the things I must say I was a little surprised at how surprised people were, You may know I have an East-West Center paper on the role of civil society in the peace process in Mindanao. And when I was doing this at a East-West Center conference, everybody was surprised at the fact that there was, in fact, an organized peace constituency in Mindanao. I mean, that is so normal in the Philippines that you forget that, you know, there was no organized Indonesian peace constituency for Aceh, for instance. There weren't demonstrations in Jakarta in support of Aceh peace and development in Aceh. So there's a lot to be done with the average person, and it's not just a matter for a few fora. I think they did six or eight throughout Mindanao once during the negotiation process. This is an ongoing process. We've got a lot of good survey data about what people think so that we could craft messages about how the peace process is going. We could have public comments where people have a chance to actually say what they think and they get listened to. We could have caucuses of various kinds and so on. I do this because while we have agreement in principle from MNLF and OPAP, what we don't have is the resources to do this. We're talking about several hundred thousand dollars worth of work down there. And so one of the prime frustrations on top of my head is the fact that a year ago I was trying to do this to hang it on the 10th anniversary of the 1996 peace agreement. Now it would be nice to at least be able to announce a launching in the 10th anniversary of this joint fact-finding initiative. But the basic point is not so much any program the Asia Foundation might or might not have. The basic point is that in the rush for a confidential, closed-door negotiation, you are going for sure to have trouble when you come out. Absolutely. Who can block the outcome? Who has legitimate interest in the outcome? Who can affect its implementation? Those people need to be in the process. Now, here at USIP, I'm probably preaching to the choir. But the point is that if we're going to be kicking the can down the road, we may as well be using the time to broaden the prospects for a lasting peace in Mindanao, which is the only way we're going to get development in Mindanao. So I think I'll leave it there and how we do it.
Thank you, Steve. All right. Open up for questions, comments. You answered all the questions.
I doubt it.
Greg, go ahead.
Would you accept a very naive question? Because I should know better, but I don't. I went to Davao about 6 years ago, and I was thrilled that people treated me like I was a war correspondent in the Big Bureau, and it was pretty cool. Having tuna sashimi in the Century Nuclear Hotel. What's it like to go to Cotabato and Sacalanga, and can you travel from one city to another safely, and is it dangerous? What do you have to worry about most?
The general rule is that you don't spend more than two nights in either Cotabato and Zamboanga consecutively, because then if there are people, it gives them a chance to get organized. You will remember there was an American serviceman killed in Zamboanga City. He was actually sort of doing perimeter security for the Balikatan a long time ago, this back during the Balikatan. So they do have a chance to get organized. I travel there I travel both in Zamboanga City and Cotabato City without escorts or anything. I just go down there. Basically, you're supposed to only stay at the Istocin Hotel in Cotabato City and a couple of hotels in Zamboanga City. The trouble in Istocin is that it gives him a monopoly position, and like all monopoly positions, he doesn't try as hard as he might. In terms of travel, the road that my staff won't let me take is the road between Cotabato and Marawi City. Even policemen have their cars hijacked there from time to time. So, but any other road, they've never given me any trouble about going, just that particular one road. So I travel all over Mindanao by land that way. When going to the islands, somebody always insists that I have an armed guard. I put it that vaguely because it depends who I'm visiting. You know, one time I was visiting the bishop, and he rustled up some soldiers to go around with me. again, I don't think that there's a lot of danger if you're in and out. The official American position is you're not supposed to stay overnight in the islands. Okay, you're supposed to be in and out, which is impossible to do unless you have your own dedicated aircraft. I'm typically accompanied by a mayor, not accompanied by, but the guest of a mayor, a governor, or the bishop of Hello, or something like that. And they do lay on armed guards. I think it's not so much that they, sort of mini-max, and they're minimizing their maximum regret. Their worst nightmare is to have something happen to a white guy. That said, Hello is actually dangerous. Hello is physically dangerous. There's been a number of daylight assassinations over the last few weeks of Marines, et cetera, downtown Hello. The mother of a guy I know and his brother were kidnapped, and the mother's been released, but the guy hasn't. A photographer on an Asia Foundation project was killed in Hello. It is dangerous. Basilan, my staff doesn't want me much to go. Tawi Tawi is fine. Tawi Tawi has got a terrible reputation because of the neighborhood, and it's actually quite safe. In short, you're welcome to contact us, okay? But however you're doing this, and we do have, we do pay a lot of attention to what's going on. We have, like I say, the constant presence, but it is not typically physically dangerous. This is, in Maguindanao in particular, a development over the last few years. A Maguindanao governor on Patuan, whatever else you might think of him, has made the province more safe. And so they now have public transportation all the time instead of stopping before dark and stuff like that. So it's much better, and I wouldn't worry about it. Like I said, we brought some American, young leader kinds of people down to Zamboanga City and had them take a look around and go out to see Sisila Peace Dialogue and so on. So it's easy to go around. Now, if you have official connections, they get very nervous. That's a nice thing about my being an NGO. I can go in and out without much trouble. There was a congressional delegation there, a staff del, just last week, and they were having all these security briefings and so on.
Yes, in the back. Identify yourself, if you would, please.
Yeah, who?
I'm wondering what role the U.S. government is playing now and what role the Philippine government, or not the U.S. government, the U.S. military is playing right now, and then the Philippine military, what activities are they involved in, are they involved in development projects, or mainly counterinsurgency?
Now you are beginning to wander into my area of ignorance, since I'm on the civilian side of everything. But I'll speak from ignorance. The American military just finished a civic action mission in Sulu, and it was. It seemed a little strange to some people because the Americans go in with their force protection and as somebody said, they look like the bad guys in Star Wars all the time because they've always got their helmets on. We see it's the difference they always talked about between the Brits in Basra and the Americans in Baghdad. The Americans in Hollo look like that. I mean, they're always all armored up and so on. But building schools, building roads, wells, that sort of thing. Now, that's episodic in the sense of they only do the civic action sort of in a push. There's a U.S. Navy Mercy ship there right now, I believe. They first called it Zamboanga, which I think is genius. They're going first to Zamboanga and doing it there, with the mayor as the host, Mayor Lobregat, the so-called oppositionist, before you're going off to Hello. Is important. It was a little bit spoiled by the fact that the President Arroyo only went to Hello to be part of it, but that's partly because Mayor Lobregat is in the opposition. He was a supporter of Fernando Poe Jr. in 2004, and the Zamboanga City has paid the price for that. There's been some retaliation from the national government side. So the U.S. military does do civic action. And they do it even on a smaller scale. They'll go down, and if they're doing even a training exercise with Philippine military on a Philippine military camp, then they'll go out and do medical missions in nearby villages. They do that kind of thing all the time. U.S. military presence is more or less constant. I think it is constant, but, you know.
It's evolving people.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the same persons all the time. It is generally believed that there is continually unmanned aerial vehicles above Jolo trying to track down the Abu Sayyaf. One actually crashed and was turned in by a farmer in return for a reward. So, you know, people say they hear a buzz, but I'm not sure that these things are supposed to buzz, but I think they're supposed to be quiet. So what's actually going on all the time is what they say the military calls intel fusion. That is, American intelligence people helping the Philippine military understand how to take intelligence data and fuse it with operations. So the Philippine military doesn't do as much civic action, and partly because of simple lack of resources. There's an engineering battalion in former Camp Abu Bakar, which builds roads when they have the money, you know, when they've got the money to buy the cement and stuff like that. In short, the short version of the answer is that U.S. military does do more than simple counterinsurgency. The Philippine military would like to do more than simple counterinsurgency, but don't have the resources, and the relationship between the two seems to be pretty good. Well, the one that determined the fate of autonomy for the Cordillera, for those of you who don't know, the reason I would call it first time tragedy, second time farce, is there were two referenda for autonomy for the Cordillera, and neither passed. Okay, and the reason why they didn't pass was by the time 1998 rolled around the second time, there had been both the local government code and the Indigenous Peoples' Rights Act. And the combination of those two legal instruments are all that people in the Cordillera really wanted. Because what people in the Cordillera really want is to be left alone in their separate villages. And that's what the Indigenous Peoples' Rights Act allows them to get. They get their ancestral domain in the separate villages. There is no region-wide identity, despite all the fact that we heard, all the talk we heard in the 80s about Igorots and Igorotan. Most of the people up there don't consider themselves Igorots. That's a term that is only ascribed to by some of the ethnic groups. Whereas no matter what you talk about divisions in Muslim Mindanao, they are all Muslims. And so they do have a basis for dialogue and for unity in the face of essentially cultural marginalization. That would be the first one. The second one is the very high level of violence. Yes, there are tribal wars in the northern Philippines, but we're talking about if a dozen people died in a year in the whole region in that, it would be an enormously large number, whereas dozens of people die in more or less random violence in Mindanao, not just Muslim Mindanao, but other parts of Mindanao, a lot. There's a famous peace zone in Sultan Gumander, which is run by a guy by the name of Bob Anton. Okay, the reason why it was possible to have it is he used to be the guy who broke the peace. And so whenever he decided to stop breaking the peace, it became a peace zone. Okay, and he's, you know, a Christian settler type, et cetera. I mean, he's a very nice guy now, but I wouldn't have wanted to meet him 30 years ago. Those are the two differences. One, basis for region-wide identity, and two, the level of violence in day-to-day life. It strikes anybody who goes there. There's guns everywhere. You know, just amazing.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Yes.
You're the only one with your hand up on that side.
Okay, there's actually the UNDP, did a good job this year. You probably know they have a human development report, but they also do country level ones. And so there's a Philippine human development report, which is mostly on the web. And one of the things they explored was Christian prejudice against Muslims. And they have some survey data, and they have some anecdotal data about, you know, what happens to Muslims throughout the country. We are working with a number of groups on this particular issue, but with the Philippine Council for Islam and Democracy, PCID, we are working on actually a wide range of issues, because what it is a council of it's not a very tight organization yet, but it's a council of people who can speak. They're sort of like bridge leaders, okay? I mean, they're all basically educated in the normal system, the so-called secular system, even if it was Notre Dame Catholic College. All it means is they're not madrasa educated. But they can talk to the muftis, they can talk to the ulama, but they can also talk to the wider community, to the military, to the Christians, and so on. So they are holding a series of roundtables where they're trying to explore these issues. They did indeed do an assessment of the 1996 peace agreement last September 2005. Mm-hmm. So last September they did, and they're trying to get it published. These are people like Amina Rasool, former youth National Youth Commission under Ramos, former Senate candidate under Fernando Poe Jr., former senior fellow here, but also people like Mayor Ali of Marawi City, former Commission on Human Rights. In other words, Muslims all, but they are interested in talking about Islam and democracy. So they, for instance, coordinate with the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy here in Washington, and they've hosted some of those people here and so on. So they are part of the general discussion of the project, along with other organizations, about what are some of the roots of anti-Muslim prejudice and how can we address those roots. But they are also part of regional dialogues among Muslims, Muslims who are interested in figuring out the role of democracy and Islam and how that relates. So there's a regional ongoing dialogue that's happened in Jakarta, Manila, Kuala Lumpur, is going to happen in Thailand, is going to get hooked up with RANS, Doha. In other words, it's trying to be part of the global discourse on that. So that's you know, region-wide. But in the Philippines, they're involved in a number of different issues. I will say one of the signs to me that the Philippine military is improving is the extent to which they are interacting with this particular institution in terms of working on Islam, democracy, prejudice, and so on. An undersecretary from the Department of Defense shows up at organizational meetings, and he's a busy man. Mm-hmm. So they care a lot about that. So there are these kinds of discourses going on. The trouble is, if I may add one more variable, we hear about the Catholic Church and its advocacy of peace through Catholic Relief Services or through the Bishops Ulama Conference and so on and so forth. Somebody once pointed out, though, that almost all the Catholic peace advocates, whether you're talking about Bert Lyson, Bert Alejo, Archbishop Ledesma, they're all in orders. They all have little initials after their name. They're Jesuits or Society of the Divine Word and stuff like that. Whereas the secular priests, the ones who are really from the neighborhood, tend not to be very sympathetic to this. And so the Catholic Church has got work to do within its own ranks to try to spread the so-called peace advocacy that's so connected to Catholicism, but bring it down to the diocesan priests who, you know, are part of the Christian-Muslim divide.
In the back, and then Mitzi.
Thank you. I'm Captain Mon from the Philippine Embassy, and I just wanted to comment on the role of the armed forces in the Philippines, as well as the United States military forces in the Philippines. Insofar as how these two outfits are practically addressing a very sensitive problem, especially in Mindanao. First of all, I would like to more or less again comment on the response made by, I'm sorry, I can't remember your name.
Yes, Steve Root.
Mr. Root.
Yeah. Now, you have to understand that as far as the armed forces of the Philippines is concerned, we do have a continuing effort as far as addressing these two problems on insurgency, one on the communist and the other one is on the secessionist in Mindanao. And as far as this campaign plan is concerned, we call it the Lambatita for the local communists, and the other one is for the secessionist. And one component here is the what we call the civil military operations, which practically addresses the issue on winning the hearts and minds of the local population on the side of the government. So I don't think that as far as, well, I do agree with you that the capability of the armed forces is very limited in terms of resources, but we do actually and very seriously implement the civil military operations aspect of winning the hearts and minds. And so therefore, it's not only the engineering, but as well as other activities, practically to win this, you know, these misguided elements of our insurgents. Okay. Now, as far as the U.S. forces, which are actually stationed right now in Mindanao, you have to understand the constitutional prohibition. And I do agree also with you that as far as the U.S. military forces is concerned, they can only, as far as our constitution is concerned, engage in humanitarian activities. And they cannot engage in any other activities other than humanitarian. And the security assistance in terms of training and exercise. So I think that's the only road as far as U.S. military forces is concerned that they're doing in the Philippines. And as far as the armed forces is concerned, we are not remiss, although it is very limited because of the constraint in our resources. But we do not have any problem as far as incorporating that in our activities, the humanitarian assistance aspect of winning the hearts and minds of the local population.
Thank you, Captain. Mitzi?
Hi, Dr. Mina. Mitzi Picard of the Asia Society. And you mentioned Noor Mitswari briefly. I was wondering what he's been up to. I know he's been prison for a while. So well, yeah, how short. And also, you alluded to some distrust of, towards GMA. And I'm wondering how the other, well, that was Mayor Lombard. I'm wondering how the Muslims perceived GMA in terms of her overtures and initiatives towards them. She deemed
it
sincere and credible.
Noor Mitswari is under, I guess, better, you know, he's out of the detention house down in
Santa Rosa,
which is where my daughter used to go to school.
in the detention center?
that area. I'm glad. He's in what amounts to semi-house arrest or up under hospital treatment and so on. I cannot tell you whether or not the Philippine government will figure out a way to release him, okay? Because you know how it is. They will talk about the necessity for undergoing the due processes of law, in which case, you know, the judge has got to throw it out and so on and so forth, as a way of saying that's why they haven't done it already. But on the other hand, very often when things need to get done, they somehow happen. And I think it's not so much what he's been doing, it's what everybody else has been doing. I think to back up a little bit, what happened was sort of simultaneously the Executive Council of the MNLF decided that Noor Mitswari needed to take on an emeritus position, that they thought that his leadership wasn't doing, you know, his day-to-day leadership wasn't doing them much good. And at the same time, the Philippine government, through the Philippine Congress, was pushing through the revised autonomy bill for plebiscite in 2001. So at the time then, Noor Mitswari was very unhappy. There was a break between him and what's called the Council of 15. But then he went back to Sulu, and his followers rose up against the fact that essentially the Philippine government was going ahead with this plebiscite on the Revised Autonomy Act against the wishes of everybody in the MNLF. This wasn't just Misauri. All factions of the MNLF disagreed with that, with going ahead. Some of them later decided to live with it, but they disagreed with it. So there was this split. Misauri's followers rose up. There was a fair amount of bloodshed. He flees to Malaysia. The Malaysians turn him over, another reason why the MNLF are not very happy with the IMT. And he's in jail. Okay, a terrible example to Hashim Salamat, one would think, about here you make a deal and you end up in jail. In the last year, there have been basically very serious efforts to reconstitute a unified MNLF. And the basic concession by the Council of 15 has been that the state commanders, etc., who were in place before the split, would take over again, no matter whether they were with Nur Misauri or the Council of 15. So all those people who are fairly prominent, such as Mayor Sena, Mayor Ali, Nawir Rasti, those who are in the Council of 15, they have all said that they're uniting behind Nur Misauri again. And that's why, they just had a meeting in General Santos on Monday where they said that they will not go to Jeddah unless Nur Misauri can go. They've been the ones who've been going to the OIC conferences, and now they're saying they won't go. So, to me, it's a very healthy development that, you know, you get some consolidation in the MNLF, it would be a way of helping at least reduce some of the organizational complexity in dealing with a peace process. Because whatever the MILF peace agreement is, it will impact on the MNLF peace agreement from 10 years ago. With respect to GMA, it's really a very mixed bag. One of my friends said he wasn't going to comment on impeachment. One of my Filipino Muslim friends from Cotabato City said he wasn't going to comment on impeachment because he didn't comment on the internal affairs of foreign countries. Fernando Po won in many of the different places in Mindanao. The places where he didn't win, it seems that he didn't win due to magic of one sort or another. So he was actually quite popular, seen as more sincere. On the other hand, the Philippine, well, people like Amina Rasul don't believe that Gloria is sincere on anything. But most of the Philippine Muslim elite believe she's sincere in wanting a peace agreement. It's in her own interest. She needs a victory. She needs a way of moving forward. But there is this continual distrust of basically anything that comes out of Manila. 200 years of marginalization and so on. However you interpret Mindanao history, and there's a considerable amount of disagreement about how to interpret Mindanao history, everybody does agree that essentially Manila's intervention, whether they're American interventions or Philippine interventions, are not very useful.
Detrimental to moral interests.
Yeah.
Other questions, comments? Okay, Kathy. Go ahead.
Well, we really stepped into my area of ignorance, but I will say, this is one of those times when I would say that, in fact, it's considerably less because the ecological niche is taken by local warlords.
It's not organized.
Triads, a triad would have to be crazy to try to operate down there. I think that it's probably a considerably less of a problem. But, I'm really ignorant there. Deliberately so.
Entrepreneurial crime rather than organized crime.
Exactly.
Not to mention family.
In Manila, of course, the elite is talking about charter change, and there's been talk about federalism and, changing to parliamentary shift. What's your impression of how the MILF and other Muslim stakeholders in the peace process
view this and how it would impact the process?
They're usually very skeptical about it because it's not involving them. I mean, these are issues that are supposed to be addressing their interests, and they're not a part of the process. Saul Santos has been writing about it, but then again, he's a Christian lawyer, so he's writing more from, you know, theoretical viewpoints. Again, they're basically saying that if you sign an agreement with us, we don't care what it takes to implement it. You have to implement it. So if it requires a constitutional change, it requires a constitutional change. It requires congressional legislation, it requires congressional legislation. That, of course, in a separation of power systems is a problem because, in fact, the executive, in some sense, cannot commit to congressional legislation. But that's, you know, so the MILF is saying we don't really care about constitutional change. What we care about is the shape of our agreement, and then you guys figure out what you have to do to your system of government to accommodate it.
Let me ask a question. Oh, go ahead, Greg.
No.
Well, I was just going to ask a question. If the can is kicked down the road until after the 7 elections, will people have patience? Will there be people who will branch off or factions that will break off and say that this is not working, we need to do something, a different tactic, more violence perhaps? Or do you think that it's possible that the MILF and the government will be able to begin a process of public consultations, which, as you say, is needed to sort of bring out a proactive dialogue to the process to involve other stakeholders?
I mean,
that seems to be the restrictions right now, that nobody's willing to talk about what the parameters are.
I don't think that it's the kind of thing that will make people impatient. The ones who are likely to break off are not the ones who are impatient for a peace agreement.
Right.
You know, so, you know, in fact, if you...
No, it'd be the ones who get frustrated and say that this is not working, so that's the more radical element.
Yeah, but I think they would get frustrated if there was a peace agreement, too. I mean, you know, in fact, it might make it more likely that they would break because it would have a, you know, make it clear what they were against.
Right.
So I don't worry about that so much. I must admit that there are people down there who do worry about that. I have talked about it. I've said, you know, what's the problem with just, continuing this sort of low-level equilibrium, and they do worry about instability and impatience. So there is a disagreement about that. I just happen to be on the optimistic version of it. Actually, I don't see any real impetus on the part of any of the parties to consult more widely. I mean, they do all sort of buy into the, confidential, we need to keep it quiet, we'll only have observers when it's official, and so on and so forth. It's just that when an outside organization such as ourselves comes and say, well, can we try this? You know, if they trust us enough, they're willing to give it a try. But they don't see it as central to their interest, I must admit.
So the question of public advocacy at this point is not very effective or active.
Right. I think we are too ignorant to do public advocacy. What would we be advocating? You know, there's a sort of a cynical reaction in the foundation that we'd be advocating sitting around singing Kumbaya or something. You know, we don't know what the shape of the peace agreement
is.
So,
true. Greg?
I don't understand why the Muslims aren't interested in the governmental issues. I mean, in the Senate, I don't know if there are any Muslims because they're all elected nationally, and I don't know about the Congress. I don't know who speaks for them. You think they'd be interested in having some voice in the federal government or central government? And even beyond that, what about just basic economic reforms that keep Mindanao, stop Mindanao from just being structurally poor? The shipping cartel, the tariffs on corn and chickens and all that. I mean, is there any interest in the Philippine government about tackling those, or are they just, you know, sort of like us with our steel lobby, you know, there's some things that are hopeless?
Yeah. Actually, that's a pair of very good questions. Because one of the grievances that the Moro National Liberation Front has with the 1996 peace agreement is their lack of representation in the national government. They're supposed to have, you know, cabinet-level posts and so on and so forth. They have things that are within the power of the executive to do that the executive has not done, and they have grievances about it. There are, as you say, no Muslim senators at the moment. There are a number of Muslim congressmen, of course, from Muslim districts. There is a league of Muslim cities, municipalities, and communities, where essentially all the mayors, a couple of them are Christian because they have large Muslim communities, but mostly Muslim mayors, 98 or 100 of them out of the 1,500 in the country, or 1,700. So it's, you know, about 1/15, 1/16 of the mayors are Muslim. So they are interested in these kinds of issues, and that's why I say we can work on these governance issues as the Asia Foundation's governance project. Someplace around here there's some information about what we do down in Mindanao, and we do a lot of local government work, you know, training local government employees, budget transparency, making the business climate a bit more friendly, and so on and so forth. I must say that it's quite striking the extent to which the particular economic issues that you raise are taken up by the Christians rather than by the Muslims. That is, the Mindanao Business Council, they will have their annual meeting in Zamboanga in late August. They are really, they're very firm on the shipping cartel, the, you know, as you say, the corn tariff and so on and so forth, that, you know, they do push those issues. Muslim business organizations, on the other hand, tend to push more parochial issues. That is, what will help Sulu, what will help Palau? Whereas, in fact, particularly the shipping cartel, Palau would really be helped because they have that one terrible port there. And, in fact, the governor of the province has got a private port, but under current rules, private ports can't carry cargo from anything but the private company to put up the private port. So there is a move nationally to let private ports carry other kinds of cargo, and they could start shipping that wonderful fruit that you can eat in Palau out. I mean, you know, the price of mangosteen's my favorite fruit, and, you know, I just eat myself sick down there because it's so cheap because they can't ship it.
Wait a minute. The governor of who has a private zone?
Governor of Sulu, Ben Loong. He has a coconut mill plant, and so he's got a private port for his coconut tanker to get the coconut oil and take it to Zamboanga. You know, a private port's, you know, just a pier about as long as this room. But lots of companies do that because the Philippine port system is so bad. Okay, and so now there's an executive order pending in the office of the president to allow private ports to take cargo from any company. But current rules have, as you say, the cartel.
And it would have to be an executive order rather than an act of Congress.
It could be an executive order, yeah, because this is a Philippine Ports Authority rule.
Now I say it's not legislation.
Right, right. Whereas some of the cabotage rules about using Philippine bottoms are just as legislated in the Philippines as they are here in the States. So,
any other last questions? Steve, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank you.
It.